The Public Safety Committee will come to order. We have a couple of bills on the agenda today, a Johnson bill dealing with appropriations, and we have a Woodard bill dealing with capital security, which we thought would be a good opportunity, even though the finances of this come under the auspices of the Department of Public Safety Transportation. We obviously are concerned about the public safety of the Capitol complex. So we'll have an overview of the what the advisory committee did over the summer and their recommendations. Do we have anything else? And then if we have time, I hope for the State Patrol that is here, we were going to, Representative Cornish, you had made a request, and I'm honoring that we hear from some of the DPS divisions that are not under our financial authority but that still have an impact on public safety, and so we're going to accommodate that request and get an overview of the State Patrol if we have time. So Representative Johnson, you're first on the agenda. If you'd like to present your bill, welcome to the committee. Can I just say for members who are present, and I'll repeat it again before you begin, Representative Johnson, is that my counterpart or the chair of the Public Safety Committee in the Senate and the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, they are not having an omnibus policy bill, so I thought there's no reason why we should, because then it just makes it complicated for me. So what we will do is, there are three bills, I think, that we laid over, and they will all be, you don't need to have your witnesses here. In fact, you don't need to say much of anything except to move your bill, and then that bill will refer to the general register, unless it goes somewhere else. However, the bill that we're hearing now and any subsequent bills that deal with money will be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety finance bill, which we will have an omnibus bill. Is that clear? We'll do those other bills on Wednesday. Representative Kiefer, I'm not sure who else has them. Representative Hillstrom, I think, has one. And then Representative Detmer has one. I don't think he needs to be here for that one.
No.
Okay. All right. Representative Johnson, I will move House File 1048 for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Finance Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. In full disclosure, let me tell you that I worked in Ramsey County Community Corrections for 35 years, just recently retired, so I had half the time that I worked there, I had juvenile probation, the other half adult probation, so it's an honor for me to be here before you to talk about this bill. For those that don't know about Minnesota and how we handle corrections, is that we're a state that relies much more on supervising convicted offenders than incarcerating them. In fact, 13 out of 14 convicted offenders are currently being supervised rather than in prison. That's an important thing to keep in mind, that we're much more a supervising state than we are one that locks people up in prison. And community supervision is much more cost-effective, $4 per day, and that's really gets to the important part of the finance part. It's much more cost-effective versus $80 to $90 a day for someone that you're going to place in prison. So it's much more cost-effective, and it's also much more effective in reducing recidivism, and that gets to the heart of public safety. When you're working with these folks out in the community, you're working with them to deal with their alcohol and drug problems. You might be working on do some intervention on COG behavioral skills areas, helping them find employment, working with their families. Most people, the vast majority, obviously, they come out of prison, end up coming back in the community. And the beauty of community supervision is you're working with them in the community, getting them integrated, and the net effect, as research shows, is reduced recidivism. Now, what House File 1048 does is provides increased state funding for counties that provide probation services. Two, in particular, the Community Corrections Act, CCA counties, and county probation officer counties, or CPO counties. And you'll see the amount in the bill. For a biennium, it's about $5.1 million. Funding for community supervision has been flat or even slightly declined over the last year in real dollars, and this is an issue that's important to those that provide probation services clearly. And much like the DOC's proposed budget, this proposal is designed simply to help keep counties keep pace in their current operation. And with me to say a few words to that effect is Josh Milo, the Community Corrections Director for Blue Earth County.
Right. Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, Josh Milo, Director of Blue Earth County Community Corrections.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd like to, on behalf of Minnesota Association of Community Act Counties, or MACAC, we're grateful to Representative Johnson and to all the co-authors for supporting this bill. As Representative Johnson mentioned, funding for community supervision has been flat in real dollars over the last 10 years. We understand that it's been a volatile 10 years for state budgets, but we also realize that over this time we've also been starting to fall behind our other criminal justice partners who have seen increases in these 10 years while we've remained flat and actually a slight reduction. Over that period, counties have kept the system running with additional property tax levy dollars. It was once about a 50-50 partnership between the state and the counties, and now it's about a 70-30% split, with the counties picking up about 70% of the funding for community corrections. In Blue Earth County, we've made changes as a result of the lack of funding over the last 10 years. We've lost staff. We have three less staff in our agency than we did 4 years ago. We're still trying to focus on our direct supervision, but it has faced its challenges. Having said that, I wouldn't say the cuts have necessarily always been a bad thing for us. It has looked at us as we've evaluated every position, we've evaluated our processes, and we've really done a better job of implementing evidence-based practices to give the services to the highest risk offenders in our community. An increase in this size that we're looking at this bill for Blue Earth County would be about $40,000. It's not a huge sum of money. It's not something that we're going to be able to add additional staff. We're not going to be able to really add additional programs. But it's just enough to try to keep pace with what we're doing currently in our county. The bottom line, community supervision is an enormous cost saving for our state. Looking about $4 per day to have somebody on supervision compared with that $80, $90 a day to be in an institution. Minnesota, still 49th per capita in how many people we put into prison, and we're towards the very top of how many people we put on community supervision, which has proven to be a very cost-effective measure. It's not that we believe in community corrections that there isn't a place for prison. There's definitely a time and place for prison. There's certain people that need to be incarcerated and be incarcerated for a long time, but the evidence shows that the bulk of the people in our society that are convicted of crimes, they can be supervised in the community by our agencies. We feel it's a relatively small investment in our services, that we can do our jobs and continue to protect the public.
Thank you for your testimony. Is it Milo, Mr. Milo?
Yes, Milo.
So, Mr. Milo, are you? I thought when we had probation here before, that I understood that the caseloads were not dramatically higher as in previous years. Am I mistaken?
I would say if you look at the probation survey, we're not at our peak of what we were several years ago. That is correct. But I'd also say that if we look at who we're focusing on and we're looking at the highest risk offenders, we're still putting a lot of service and a lot more services into people than we did 10 years ago. When you do evidence-based practice, when you're really identifying those criminogenic needs, it is more labor intensive. So although we might not have the highest numbers that we had in supervision, we still have a lot of work to go with those offenders.
And in the governor's budget, the change items would include salary increases for in both CPO as well as CCA probation officers. Is that correct?
The governor's budget was just for the Department of Corrections for their community supervision and for their institutions. The governor's budget did not include any additional monies for the county partners in his bill.
And Representative Johnson, so so this money would go for what? If it was approved, if your bill was approved,
it would go to the Community Corrections Act counties and the CPO counties.
I know, and Representative Johnson, what would it be used for? Is the intent to hire additional probation officers, augmented technology. What's the... please introduce yourself to the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ryan Erdman. I'm the executive director for MACAC, and I also do AMC's public safety work. And this, the line items that this money would go to are the Community Corrections Act subsidy and the CPO reimbursement, which are line items within the DOC's budget. However, those line items were held flat in the governor's budget proposal. And what we do with them, as Josh noted, similar to what the DOC will be using their money for going forward, really our counties are facing deficits in their department. They're looking at further reductions or having to supplement their departments with additional county levy dollars. And at this dollar amount that we're looking at, 4%, we're really just filling that gap and plugging the hole. To really do a lot of the more expansive items would require additional resources beyond that. Again, in this bill was drafted to be consistent with the DOC's budget. Again, that 4% is a pretty good target. It's what the governor recommended for them, and for us it can help plug a hole, like I said, but it isn't enough money to do too many new or innovative things. It really just keeps us from going back.
So, Mr. Erdman, I'm just confused here. So what you're saying is you the governor's budget has the increase, salary increase at 4%, and you want also that, is it that 4% also, is this for salary increases or to hire new probation officers?
That's Mr. Chair, that's going to vary by county. In some cases, depending on the union contracts, there would be salary increases. In other cases, salaries actually have been held flat. Some of the counties don't even have steps in their contracts anymore, but there's still health care cost increases that create ongoing budget problems if there aren't increases to kept up with funding. And the way it's been managed as we've gone down, as Mr. Milo said, is really with additional county levy dollars and adding levy dollars to the pot to keep the department whole. Rather,
Mr. Erdman, I appreciate that. I guess I'm just trying to figure out where you came up with this amount, and I'm not. Is it attached to something that from the governor's change items or something else?
Mr. Chair, I will admit it is somewhat arbitrary. We chose 4% just to get a hard number to figure out where that would be. It's consistent with the governor's increase for the DOC, so it added some parity and equity in that regard. And in fact, when directors like Josh look at their budget, they see what their potential deficit is going forward, and this 4% is roughly consistent with the amount of money that they would need to sort of plug anticipated gaps in their budget.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, when you don't have enough, I think I know the answer to this question, but when you don't have enough probation officers and they are not actually having the time to supervise whether there's use or whether folks are actually complying with treatment, do you actually find that then there's more probation violations that result and more likely people to go to prison?
Mr. Milo, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, a bit of a softball, but that's exactly correct. The probation officers are really your front line in providing public safety in the community for ensuring that these folks are doing what their probation conditions provide, whether it's going to AA or getting their chemical dependency treatment or seeing their job counselor, all that sort of thing, all the things that necessary to get them integrated back in the community. So there's no doubt of the importance and the efficacy of these POs.
Any other softballs, Representative Hillstrom? Okay.
No, that's enough.
Your other testifier?
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Bruce Hagstrom. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers today. I'm a probation officer in Chisago County. I've been there for 20-plus years. To get back to an earlier question, yes, our numbers are down. I have a specialized caseload. I supervise domestic offenders exclusively in a small county. That's kind of rare. My caseload peaked several years ago at about 150 clients. Right now I'm at about 130, 135. So yes, our numbers are down. But I'm one person supervising a caseload of 135 people. Now, with evidence-based practices, risk needs assessments, I'm able to pay attention to the highest risk third. The rest of them, it's paper probation. I don't mean to say that I don't pay any attention to them, but I rely on law enforcement in the community to kind of keep tabs on those people and let me know whether or not they're behaving. I make sure they do their programming. I make sure they pay the restitution. I make sure that they follow the other conditions of probation. The 4% number is, granted, somewhat arbitrary. Our portion of that is about $254,000. We have continually lost. CPO reimbursement, according to 244.19, is supposed to be 50%. That is that the DOC is supposed to reimburse the counties for 50% of the probation officers' salaries. That doesn't mean that we get 50% of our budget. Our office staff, our technology, all that comes from the county. So as it stands now, this fiscal year, our reimbursement was about 31%. All things being equal, we're with increased costs, we're going to be down around 29%. This bill will get us at about 30%. So in order to get us just to keep our head level, it would cost about $553,000 just for the CPO reimbursement account. So this is really not keeping pace. We've been in discussion with the Department of Corrections, with MACAC, about how to do a better job of projecting our costs and how to get closer to the number we need to be able to do the job that we need to do. And I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Representative Johnson says corrections support your, I suppose they can't really say do that, can they? Have you had conversations with the commissioner about this?
I have not. Mr. Chair, I haven't spoken to the commissioner about this.
Very good. You have a question, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, or whoever wants to answer this question, is there a caseload that you reach that going above is ineffective? Like 135 caseloads for one person sounds like a great deal.
Chairman Paymar, Representative,
extra.
Back in about 94, 95, there was came out of the legislature, there was a study commission, caseload workload reduction, all right? And part of the effort there was to define what is a reasonable caseload, okay? A lot of people, a lot smarter than I am, put together some numbers, did some research, and they came up with an idea of what it would cost to bring probation to where it needed to be. Legislature appropriated money out of that, but we got about a third of what we needed to get where we needed to be. And from that point on, since about 1997, we've been taking hits repeatedly because our costs keep going up, and the cost gets passed on to the county. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson, do you have any? Oh, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, whoever would like to, who can possibly answer this question. First of all, I want to thank the probation officers for what they do. Being in law enforcement, I've been able to work with some of them, and I'm not sure if I've actually talked to you on the phone yet or not, working in Isani County. But the question I have is, how much money are we spending right now on supervising people on misdemeanor probation? For a misdemeanor crime.
Representative Johnson.
I don't have that number. Do you have that number?
Mr. Milo.
Mr. Chair, I haven't seen any numbers that have really gone down to that level of detail of supervision just for misdemeanor offenders only. I'm not sure if at a later time if the department has any numbers on really being able to bifurcate out the misdemeanor to gross misdemeanor felony, but I haven't seen that.
Commissioner, do you have anything? Can you add to this at all, or do you want to add to it at all? Why don't you come up for a second? as long as you're standing, maybe you can just come on up and just if you. Commissioner Roy, I didn't want to sort of put you on the spot here, but if you have anything to add, and also about if you can comment on the Representative Johnson's bill, maybe.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. It is not the first time in this committee that I have commented on the importance of probation and the importance that probation officers play in keeping prison populations low. Representative Johnson has commented about, and Mr. Milo has commented both about our low prison populations, and in fact, that low prison population is greatly due to the existence of Community Corrections Act and our county probation partners. So I would certainly support, and I have recommended support to individual committee members for support of our community partners. I'm reluctant to comment specifically on numbers, but we are in the process of analyzing the ratios of caseload and officers, which I think is what some of the members are getting to, and we're also trying to connect costs related to those ratios. What is difficult for many people to understand is our three delivery systems. And when money is appropriated for our County Community Corrections Act and our county partners, the decision on how to spend that money lies with the Community Corrections Act directors and the county directors. And they can choose to hire more probation officers. They can choose to give raises to their existing probation officers. They can use that money to expand programming. And that really is the philosophy of community and county corrections, is that it is not mandated services by the Department of Corrections. So when you ask questions about ratios and service delivery, it varies greatly from county to county, and it is that quandary that makes some of this financial discussion fairly difficult. But an overall support of this, I would put my stamp on it in a second, that it is about time. And I came out of the Community Corrections Act world in my previous life, and I often had to lay people off because of the state reduction in the subsidy.
Question to the commissioner, or other question to Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair, this would be a comment, and I, like you, naturally wonder where we're going to get all this money, where it's going to come from, and who we're going to short in one area to give more in another. But in this area, even the right-leaning organization Right on Crime, I think, supports ideas like this in the Texas policy, where due to the overcrowding our prisons, especially in Minnesota, where the commissioner said we pride ourselves on putting in the most serious criminals and release which ones we can be, expresses in itself a real need for probation. And I think as we go along here in the future and talk about releasing more people and keeping only the worst, it's even more important that we fund these probation officers so they can be an integral part of our whole public safety program. So in theory, I also put my stamp on this. I just don't know where the money's going to come from yet.
Very good. Not seeing no further questions, Representative Johnson, I will renew my motion to lay House File 1048 over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus finance bill. Thank you for bringing it forward, unless you have some further comments.
No, that should do it. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee.
Next on the agenda is House File 275, Representative Woodard. Representative Woodard, welcome to the committee. have somebody move House File 275. Representative Johnson moves House File 275, and the motion would be that it would pass and be referred to Transportation Finance. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 275. It's a direct result of some work that the two gentlemen sitting next to me have been heavily involved in, and that is a risk assessment of the Capitol Complex security procedures. And no strangers to the committee, but Assistant Commissioner Danaski, as well as Major now Meyerson, will be helping me out here this morning. But as we went through the task force and looked at the risk assessments that have been performed all the way from the National Guard to the legislative auditor over the last few years, two things became apparent to the task force. One is that we needed more clear direction to the Department of Public Safety and the state troopers on exactly who is responsible for the Capitol Complex security. So this bill attempts to provide that clear direction. And then secondarily, we determined that we needed some additional help from the state troopers with additional personnel. So that is also in this bill. That additional personnel would support those of our members who are concealed carry, who are currently part of our protection detail here at the Capitol, so the state troopers could support them in that effort. Those are the main components of the bill. The governor's budget does have $1 million placeholder to be able to provide for this bill. I know that the Senate also has a fiscal note that's a little bit higher than that. I'll let Assistant Commissioner Danaski possibly walk through that with us. But if that, Mr. Chair, if you're okay, we'd let Assistant Commissioner Danaski take it over from here.
Yeah, Representative Woodard, I'm just wondering, we also have an overview of the of Capitol security. We just want to do this all at one time here. Would you, Commissioner, is that what you'd like to do? Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Mark Danaski, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. And as you mentioned, I think I'll just make a few comments on the recommendations of the bill, and then I'll turn it over to Major Meyerson to talk about the current security and how this might impact the security here. I want to thank Representative Woodard and all the members of the bipartisan committee that came together over the summer to work on this. As you may or may not be aware, there were, as I say, bipartisan. There was two members of the House, two members of the Senate, member of the Judiciary, Justice Anderson, and the committee was chaired by the Lieutenant Governor. There was a number of advisors on this committee. We actually sought out members from the private community. We had an expert from Target Security. The University of Minnesota sent representatives to our meetings, and we also had a private security representative who has expertise in judicial security coming and commenting to the committee over the course of our meetings. So there was a lot of information that was exchanged. As Representative Woodard said, this is the culmination of, and I've been with public safety for 30 years, over the last number of years, probably 20 years, there's been at least 7 formal studies and reports on the Capitol Complex security. As was mentioned, BCA has done a study, the United States Secret Service has done a study, recently the Minnesota National Guard did a comprehensive study, and most recently the Legislative Auditor did a study on Capitol security. In fact, if you look at all those recommendations, which the committee did, the studies, a lot of the issues were consistent, and a lot of the recommendations across those studies, even over the course of the past decade, were pretty consistent. And we're grateful that this committee came together, looked at all those, and then did make a recommendation to address some of those issues. As we will talk about probably at some point, there is a significant fiscal component to this, but I'd like to point out that the committee didn't focus on the fiscal portion of it entirely. In fact, a significant portion of the conversation in the committee, and I hope I'm not speaking out of turn for Representative Woodard here, was on policies and procedures and how things are done on the complex. The major will talk about the size of our complex and all the things that go on here, but it isn't just about having more people. It's about education. It's about having people understand what's going on so that we can create collectively a culture of safety on the complex, not just because we have security personnel here, but rather that everybody that works and visits here has an understanding of what the expectations are. Some of the things that were talked about and Representative Woodard pointed out in the bill are the formalizing of a final authority in the location of the Commissioner of Public Safety. It's pretty consistent now, but what you probably don't understand or what people maybe don't understand is because of how dispersed we have security now, and as I said, the major will talk about our contracted services. What you may not know is that how security responds to a fire alarm in the Capitol might be different than how you might do something in the Department of Transportation or might be different than it is at the History Center. And that's because of the diversity of the security processes that are out there. What the bill does in two fashions is it does make the Commissioner of Public Safety the final authority for determining what those policies and procedures will do, and then it also talks about an emergency manager coming in. As you may not be aware, there are two licensed peace officers assigned on a permanent basis to the Capitol Complex. Major Meyerson is one, and there's a lieutenant as well. Those two individuals have the responsibility for the budget, for oversight, for management, and everything else. It's a daunting job, and what the committee discovered was that we really needed somebody to focus on those policies and procedures and work with the stakeholders and the people that are on the complex to talk about how do we educate members. As a matter of fact, Mr. Chair, I remember having the conversation with you. Who do we have in Capitol Security that comes and talks to the stakeholders that are working here to talk about what do we do in case there's a heart attack? What to do in case somebody walks up and I feel uncomfortable about this individual that's talking to your legislative assistant, or your legislative assistant feels uncomfortable? What action should they take? What should they do? Who should they call? Should they do something? Should they do nothing? Unfortunately, there's nothing like that in place right now. And just having somebody that can talk about that and combine and put consistency to the procedures and speak with stakeholders about the kinds and types of trainings that we can provide, we think is an integral part of the process. I think that one thing that I would like to point out, as this has been brought forth a number of times, and as I said, there is significant resources that are put forward on it. The executive branch, as well as the legislative branch at times, is hesitant to look at resources and say, geez, do we really want to spend money on ourselves? And what was brought out numerous times in this committee, and I think Justice Anderson speaks to it very eloquently, is this isn't just about the executive branch or about the legislators that are here. This is more importantly about the 7,500 employees that the state has to work on the entire Capitol complex, as well as the tens of thousands of visitors that come and visit this establishment. Not only this establishment, but all the structures and all the facilities on the 140 acres that make up the Capitol complex. So as we started talking about it, it wasn't so much about protecting ourselves as it was taking care of the structure, the facility, the seat of government, and justice for the state of Minnesota, as well as the individuals that come and visit this location. So as I mentioned, the Department of Public Safety is grateful for the committee's work. We're very supportive of this. And I'll finish with, we're very excited actually about the concept that the committee is a standing committee. And it is required to meet on a quarterly basis, and the Department of Public Safety is required to make a report to that committee on an annual basis. So the conversations, the dialogue that we had all summer long talking about what's good, what's not good, where can we go, what are potential legislative pieces that we can put out there, we'll be moving forward on an annual basis now as part of this legislation. And I feel that just even that governance body talking about who is the final authority and how do we get information from everybody that's involved so we can make sound decisions is a good process. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will cease my testimony. Take any questions if you like.
Testify about the committee or no?
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd Please. Like to just speak a little bit further about an overview of Capitol Security and what we have, and perhaps give some clarity to what our staffing is, the composition, and our funding source, and some of the difficulties that come as a result of that.
Very good. Please.
Okay. Briefly, the Capitol Security is comprised of both civilian security officers as well as licensed police officers, and as the assistant commissioner said, we have two licensed police officers on staff here on a year-round basis, myself and a lieutenant, and we have a wide range of responsibilities all the way from the advanced planning and budgeting to the operations when there's a need for a police officer's presence. You'll see that we do have a couple more troopers on staff during the legislative session, and we do augment our efforts bringing troopers in on a temporary assignment, and at times we do ramp that up depending on what the circumstances are and the activities going on at the Capitol. On the civilian side, we have a staff currently of 40 civilian security officers, and they are assigned throughout the Capitol complex, and I want to point out that the Capitol complex is so much more than people first think of when they consider the Capitol. They think of the Capitol State Office Building and the lawn area, but we do have 140 acres that we are responsible for, and that is all the way from Pennsylvania Avenue up by the Highway Federal Credit Union, the MSRS building, to south of I-94, the Anderson Building and the History Center, and then over to I-35E. So it's a large footprint that we're responsible for, So when you take those 40 officers 24 hours a day and put those in all the different buildings where we have business occurring, it's rather thin. And how they're funded is significant. 28 of those officers are funded through contracted services. And what's significant about that, we don't have the direct appropriations that fund all 40. We rely on the agencies to determine if it's a priority within their department. For example, the Department of Transportation, they contract with the Department of Public Safety, and we hire the officers to staff that building. I have one FTE that is assigned there Monday through Friday, as an example. And we have the same arrangement at different levels, depending on what the priority level is of those buildings, to have a contract with the Department of Public Safety. So where we have a little bit of dysfunction there is we don't have the ability, when we have an observation and determine that we need to staff differently, we are committed through these contracts to maintain these contract, these staffing locations and posts. We staff the buildings as well as the Capitol when we have the ability, but basically our minimums as staffing comes through what our contracts with these different agencies will allow. The functions of the officers is they serve as deterrent, obviously, and also detecting any type of activity, whether it's criminal activity. We also are involved in parking enforcement. We contract with the Department of Administration to monitor the parking lots and do our parking lot enforcement as well. It was observed through the committee, I think, that we have a lot of vulnerabilities. When one is asked about security on the Capitol complex, depending on what's going on in the country at any given time, a person will reflect on that and consider that the security. Right after any type of an active shooter incident, I think people have a tendency to focus on active shooters. When we have natural disasters, that falls within the realm of responsibility of Capitol security. So we have vulnerabilities that come from any number of different threats. And I think that as we consider going forward, we need to take that into consideration. One thing I want to step back and mention, during the legislative auditor's observation reports, in his report in 2009, he identified that Minnesota had was the fourth lowest in staffing licensed police officers on the Capitol complex. And through what we're, not we, but the committee is recommending increasing to 12, that only puts us up 10 positions relative to the number of police officers on Capitol complexes in the United States. We didn't make the observations, however, in a vacuum. We did rely on input from the outside experts that came from the corporate, judicial, and the university settings as well. So with that, you have any other questions or
Thank
any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Meyerson. And I'd just like to echo that was a major gap, I think, in the work that we did, and I'd like to thank Mr. Meyerson and the Commissioner and Representative Woodard for all the days we spent working on this. But you know, the amount that's being in the governor's budget is not near what it should be. I think he's recommending $1 million, and I believe we discussed $6 million to do what we thought was necessary to bring the Capitol complex up to its optimum security level. And I think we talked about increasing the licensed police officers from 2 to 12, and security guards from 40 to 67, and so this is going to remain an ongoing problem, but we don't have the resources, although I challenged Representative Woodard to come up with the additional $5 million by raising taxes, but he has refused as of late. So Representative Simon, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Woodard and others who have been involved in this effort. I think it's important, and not just because we work here. I will say, Capitol Security, I really have to say you guys do a great job. I had an episode 3 years ago that you helped me with, and I was just really impressed by the way you handled it. And, you know, it's tough when that happens. You get a constituent or someone else who does things they shouldn't do, but I really appreciate that. But here are my questions. You talked, and others have talked about how since 1973 there have been all these reports. I don't know enough about the history. Have we had sort of what I'd call a close call here at the Capitol? I mean, since 1973, has there been a, you know, I know this is a maybe impossibly broad question, but have we had an incident where someone sought to do harm on a mass level here at the legislature, either in one of the galleries or somewhere else? What's the history there?
Commissioner Dance, I do you want to answer that? I mean, Can I just ask the committee? I've been really sort of split on this, and I'll leave it up to your professional judgment. We had a number of closed-door meetings, and I don't know. I just am nervous. I think that there's problems at the Capitol complex, and I'll leave it up to your judgment how you want to answer that question.
Mr. Chair, let me, if I could just intercept that for a second. Let me say, I'm not asking you to disclose anything that would compromise future security efforts, and you can be as vague as you wish. I'm just asking in the last, basically, I guess it would be 40 years, broadly and generally, without naming names or types or whatever, have we had some near misses? Is that fair to say? But feel free to just not answer and tell me that if you think it'll compromise any ongoing efforts. I don't want to do that, obviously.
Major.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate your appreciation for the sensitivity of this, and we did have non-public sessions to discuss some of the vulnerabilities, but I will say that we have had threats that I believe, if they had not been addressed, would have manifested into something greater. And we have, on an ongoing basis, we have things come to our attention that we do address with the given resources that we have. And I do believe that, to answer your question, yes, we have had some, and specifically I prefer not to address those.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon. No, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add a little supplement from a layman's term on what we saw and what the committee worked on. And I would say the first thing that was the most dramatic thing for me is that there wasn't a real risk-based approach to this, that we have several occupants of the Capitol complex that don't really fall within the category of Capitol complex security today. So they have their own risk assessment. They do their own thing. And it isn't part of a bigger program. And I think that was one of the bigger issues that I saw in the entire process, and one of the things that, you know, I'm not a big fan of spending more money. But this is the right approach, because we looked at it from a risk-based approach, not just, let's see, Iowa has, you know, 75 state troopers in their capital. We should have at least 80 so that we one-up them. It really is an approach that looks at all of these different reports we've seen from the professionals on where the risks lie, where the vulnerabilities lie, and how do we address those. And I think that's it's an important point.
Representative Simon.
Well, I want to make sure I'm asking the question in a sensitive way so that you're not disclosing any sort of secrets or strategies that might be helpful. And this is one example where I don't think we all need to know all the details, particularly if it would compromise security. So I'm happy not knowing things. I am. That happens to me every day. I do have one question, though, about metal detectors. I'm sure this has come up a lot. I've been to a lot of capitals, I think almost half. That seems like a lot to me. I can only remember one, Tennessee, that had metal detectors. I'm sure that's an ongoing subject, and I've been off this committee for a couple years, so maybe you've had exhaustive discussions. But I'm sure that's something that comes up. Where are we on the decision whether or not to do that, or is that kind of down the road?
Appropriate question. Representative Woodard, do you want to like go down that road?
Mr. Chair, this was certainly an issue of, and I see that you guys are looking to me to answer that question, because it is somewhat of a political question as opposed to really a risk-based question. And I would tell you that the Department of Public Safety has been very good about, you tell us what you think is right, because there is a delicate balance here between keeping this complex open to the people, and that not just open, but also feeling like it is open, that as a Minnesotan, you can enter this facility at any time, talk to people you need to talk to, have your grievances heard, petition your lawmakers. And I think that's the critical piece. Where I stand on it is, I don't think it's necessary to have metal detectors in this building. as long as we have a good risk-based approach to our security plan, and I think that's what we do here. Now, that is not necessarily the opinion of all members of the committee. There are members who would rather see the metal detectors. The overall answer is that, you know, it will be an ongoing discussion. I'm against it myself.
And then, Mr. Chair, just if I might, just one last follow-up.
Let me just say something about that Representative Simon, because we did have a difference of an opinion. It's certainly not political, but it's more of how individual members of the committee saw public safety in the Capitol complex. And Minnesota is one of 27 states that does not have metal detectors at the public entrances to a Capitol building. And for that matter, if you were to go into the Ramsey County Courthouse and the Hennepin County Courthouse, you would go through a metal detector. But we had, what we did do is we originally had a mission statement that said that we would keep the Capitol open in reality and in perception. And we moved that out of the actual report to the legislature, because there was division about this, and I'd have to say that I was one who, while I wasn't recommending the installation of metal detectors, I wanted to keep that conversation open, that there may be times and particular events at the Capitol when we might want to use that. But I think I share everybody on the committee's fear of something happening. I mean, it is an open building, and to not talk about it, I think, is a mistake. To not have that on the table as a possible security enforcement in the future, I think, would also be a mistake. So there wasn't unanimity on that whole discussion, but Representative Woodard, I think, has classified it correctly. Representative Simon, you had another question.
Well, this may be, again, intruding on existing plans, so maybe I'll just make a comment and invite a response, and if you'd rather not, for the reasons that we discussed, that's fine. Like I said, I'm happy not knowing things. But so if we're not going to have metal detectors, it just seems to me, and I'm an amateur when it comes to the security stuff, so tell me where I'm wrong, but I've sometimes, when we take up particularly controversial issues on the floor of the House, I sort of eyeball the gallery, and I don't always see, you know, Capitol Police. Maybe it's the angle of my chair, maybe I'm not looking or seeing, and I just sometimes wonder myself, if you had a violent attention seeker, it seems to me it's a no-brainer. That's where they'd want to maximize their efforts. They wouldn't go to an individual office. They'd do something in the gallery. And so I'm wondering, and maybe you can't or don't wish to comment about that, but are there things we can do in terms of the galleries? We debate a lot of, you know, serious and important issues that people are very, very passionate about, and sometimes I look up at the gallery and I wonder what could be going on up there.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, 2 points. Going back, and I hate to open up the metal detector again, but I will make the comment that in our conversations, there was a lot of talk also with the Department Administration on the Capitol renovation. And as part of that renovation process, we are going to work with the Department Administration and the contractors as part of the overall security program, so that on a continuum of security, talking about what you're talking about, being on a low end where everything is open, all the way up to where we receive a potential threat, we have the ability to move in that continuum. And there may be a time when, through this process, the Commissioner of Public Safety deems that metal detectors may be needed, that we may move to that thing. So at least we're thinking about it from the standpoint of infrastructure. And the second point is when you talk about being in the galleries, I think that the members of this committee would genuinely be surprised at how active the Capitol security is, and to Representative Woodard's point about keeping this complex open both in reality and perception, Capitol security works very, very diligently to have significant security in place, particularly when there's something of controversy going on, but holding down the presence of law enforcement and our troopers so it doesn't look like it's a police state. Generally, we want people to feel like this is a free place to be, but I can assure you, please be assured that there is significant security in place should there be something taking place.
Also, just to finish off that discussion on metal detectors, I want to say that in the legislative auditor's report, there was a recommendation by the BCA superintendent in 2000 to install 14 metal detectors. This issue has been around for a long time. I don't think it's going to go away. Representative Schoen was next, unless you have more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was going to actually touch on a couple things. It was maybe not get so specific, but maybe not the whole complex, but location specific. It sounds like maybe you've thought about that a little bit, and I was actually going to ask for more detail, not openly, but I think there's a few of us in the room that understand tactics and tactical advantage and what's going to happen. And I certainly look around at certain hearings, and when you talk about, what did you say, like 14,000 employees and all the visitors, and they're here because we're bringing up some pretty controversial ideas sometimes that tear the state apart, sometimes evenly. But what I get concerned about is exactly that, Representative Woodard, is that those decisions do become political versus logical. And I hope that those things are in place in that committee, Mr. Chair, and members that sit on that, that, you know, that we are taking everything into account logically versus more politically.
And Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Woodard.
Representative Schoen. You know, the word political may have been misused, because what I meant by political is that there is a balancing act here between the fact that this is a state building and it needs to be accessible by the citizens of Minnesota. If this were not, if it were a Target headquarters, you would take that to its extreme, or not to its extreme, but to its full extent, and say, we're going to treat this as a building in which we want to protect at every stage, and that is the primary goal. I don't need to have people in the public visiting me at Target headquarters. But this is a different facility than that. This is the people's house. This is where their representatives are. This is where they want to be able to come and interact with you as a representative, even if sometimes it's uncomfortable. So that's the balancing act I'm getting at. It's not political because I'm a Republican, I think this, and because you're a Democrat, you think something different. It is because this is a different place. This is a special place that's not the headquarters of the Target Corporation. I would also add that one of the things that that they do that we've talked about, of course, is there is close coordination with the Sergeant-at-Arms office, both in the Senate and the House, on what's happening. You know, what is coming up in the bills? What is it that's going to be controversial? How do we need to handle that? You'll notice that in the last session when we had controversial bills up, they had special procedures upstairs for the gallery, that it wasn't normal operating procedures for those particular situations. So that's what I mean by that. And you're very familiar with this, Representative Schoen, about the risk-based approach here, that doesn't mean that we have to do that every single day on every single event. It's that we take a look at these guys take a look at the risk and the vulnerabilities, and then determine how do we mitigate those risks and vulnerabilities.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, and thank you for taking this on, because I know this wasn't an easy process for years after years since you've been talking about it, probably since the 70s, so or people long before us, so thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Woodard, I also applaud you for taking this on, and Commissioner and Major, I just have I was going to ask this in a question, but I'll make a comment instead, because I think it does get into you know, what you can, how you can answer, and what you can answer, and things of such. But you know, when I first started, I've been down here four terms now. When I first started, I became real familiar with a number of what we used to call redcoats. You know, there's no more redcoats, freshmen. You haven't had the pleasure to maybe see the redcoats, but we used to call them redcoats. And so I would, you know, I just, and I know that many of them were retired patrol, so I've got friends that are retired patrol, and I became friends with a lot of the redcoats, and I would just ask them, you know, about different things. And I know that, you know, they, you know, you can't share, no matter who it is, no matter if it's a representative, a senator, or governor, or whoever, asking some specific questions. But, you know, I would ask about what if this happened, or what if that happened, or what if this happened, or what if that happened. I'm going to make this comment. It was surprising and shocking to me that, and nothing was revealed to me, quite frankly and honestly, but it was indicated to me that, you know, there were some, if there was an event, or there was a threat, or there was an emergency of some sort, that we didn't have protocol, or there was no protocol on some specific kind of what I would consider major events. And I got here late, I apologize, Mr. Chair, I apologize to you, so maybe you talked about that. But I hope that for every event that we can think of, whether it be a bomb, or a chemical, or a gun, or whatever, kidnapping or assault or whatever, that there is some kind of protocol. And you mentioned tactical information or how it's dealt with. Because to me, early on in my career, that didn't appear to be true for all events. And I'll just make that statement. And maybe I was not told that because I couldn't be told that or whatever. So I just wanted to make that statement that I hope all, as many situations as possible is looked at, and we have protocol and a way to respond to all events. I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to try to ask a couple of questions that you can't answer. And this will probably be for the Assistant Commissioner, I think. But as I look at the language in the bill, my question is about the term emergency manager. And I'm just curious if that's a internal term or if you're actually going to be establishing an emergency manager that would function as an emergency manager under the letter of the law.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Members. The emergency manager position, and I guess I'd have to ask for some clarification, when you say emergency manager under the letter of the law, referring to like a county emergency manager?
Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, letter of the law was probably a bad term. Emergency manager as in a certified emergency manager under FEMA, state of Minnesota.
Commissioner
Mr. Chair, Representative Members, while that hasn't been defined specifically, we looked at that emergency manager position very similar to where we have emergency managers within the Department of Public Safety in our section of Homeland Security and Emergency Management that works with the counties and local jurisdictions in developing plans for the incidents that we've talked to today and about looking at vulnerabilities and how do we mitigate some of those issues. My suspicion is that as we've looked at job classification and qualifications, that many of the things that you talk about, the individual being certified through the state, through HSEM, and particularly through FEMA, would probably fall, that we would want them to do that.
Representative Simons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my final question, would this new position of emergency manager, would I assume correctly this would be a licensed peace officer?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Members, at this time we do not anticipate it being a licensed peace officer.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question here. I've been mulling this over in my mind as listening to the conversation. Would adding additional full-time staff, would that, including an emergency manager, would you, just a ballpark figure, would you actually realize a greater savings than what you're currently putting out in overtime expenditures?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Members, there will be no savings. I'm just going to be blunt. There is no savings. There's a significant number associated with the resources that are being recommended by the committee on this. So, no, there would not be any savings.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, can I just...
Representative Woodard.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair and Representative Neuberger, just to supplement that a bit, and you don't have a copy of this, but the Senate fiscal note also recognizes that we spend about, I believe it's $1.5 million on security contracts that occupants of the complex today pay the DPS in order to provide those security services. That would be used, that we repeal that, and that money, and we need to clarify this in a future amendment, will be put into the general fund to offset these expenses. And Commissioner Donaski is absolutely right. It's not a savings, but it's not that it becomes all this new free money that agencies will be able to use. We're going to use that existing resource.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I commend your department and your staff here for the security they do. They do an excellent job. I've spent 27 years in law enforcement, and when I'm walking around here, I'm always looking at things where some problems could arise from. And generally, I find your staff have already taken care of those issues before I even can think of them. Now, the question I have, when you've been doing these studies for a while, when was the last time the number of security staff or the security details was last increased?
Mr. Meisen.
Mr. Chair, members, The increase in staff for troopers, I don't recall the last time the troopers were increased. We had an increase of security officers, I believe it was a year and a half ago, and it was because we entered into a new contract with Military Affairs to staff an officer at their building, and about a year before that, and I may have two converted here, with MSRS, so we increased by two. So all of our staffing increases have come through new contracts with different departments throughout the complex.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, and for the members, just to clarify, and I'll just use approximate numbers now. For the capital complex, the fund is approximately $3 million. It's a little more than that, but it's about $3 million. And in fact, half of that money that we use for capital complex security is actually through contracts with individual agencies. So only about $1.5 million is direct appropriation for capital security to Major Myers, and the rest all comes from agencies that are out there. And that is part of the problem, is that we have a series of haves and have-nots. If you happen to have a department that wants security and has excess funds available, you can provide security for it. You may be in an organization or a department that has a genuine security risk, but you don't have the additional funding for it, and consequently you don't get funded because we don't have the funds available to do it. So part of what Representative Woodard's legislation does is combines all that so that we move more towards a vulnerability threat proposition where we have one organization that's looking across the entire complex and determining where we should deploy our resources in a more more efficient manner.
Any other questions? I just wanted to add one other thing that I think is important in this bill is this whole idea of tenant training. And some of you who've been around here for a while might remember when we had a little bit more, when we had resources, we used to have, when you think of a building like this, for instance, we used to have someone on each floor. As you left the elevator, there was someone there where you could say, you know, where's Representative Lohmer's office, and you'd get reported over there. Now, I'm not sure how much training those individuals had, but, you know, this is a, you know, it's sort of a gap now, and you know, people are just, you know, freely walking into the state office building, and like a lot of buildings in the Capitol complex, and I really hope that as we move forward that the committee makes some really concrete recommendations on how to provide more training to our staff. You know, we're not necessarily looking for someone who's, you know, there's lots of situations, and I speak from some experience in the domestic violence field. I mean, we want to know if we have a staff member here whose husband or wife has an order for protection taken out or is calling, repeatedly calling, and how are we providing training, or a disgruntled employee. These are all things that should be part, I think, of our whole security situation, and not just, you know, not just the obvious holes here with the lack of staff. So anyway, that was another discussion that we had, and we keep going forward. Representative Woodard, we'll see what happens. Thank you so much for bringing the bill, and Representative Johnson will renew his motion that House File 275 passes and gets re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. Any discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Woodard, and thank you, Commissioner and Major Meyerson. I need a motion to approve the minutes of February 27th. Representative Rosenthal moves the minutes of February 27th. Is there any discussion on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. We have about 20 minutes. We're shortchanging you, Colonel. Is it Colonel Daly? But maybe you could just start. We don't have oversight over your budget, but clearly the work of the State Patrol fits under our authority as the Public Safety Committee. So I don't know if you have a presentation or if you're just, but welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. Colonel Kevin Daly, State Patrol. I don't have a PowerPoint, but I do well relish the opportunity to give you a brief overview of your State Patrol. I'm quite proud to be the Colonel. First of all, I'd like to start with our mission statement, if I can, Mr. Chair. The mission of the State Patrol is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota roadways. That's our mission. Within that mission, we have a set of core values that are near and dear to my heart and as well as the each and every employee in the State Patrol. And those core values are respect, integrity, courage, and honor. And the expectation is every day with every contact with every citizen, whether it be investigating a crash or arresting someone for a crime, we expect our employees to treat people with respect, and they do, and I'm quite proud of that. Some data from 2012 that I thought you may find interesting. In 2012, there were 649,000 enforcement contacts. Not necessarily all citations or arrests. Warnings are included in that number, but 649,000 enforcement contacts. Within that, those contacts with the public and people traveling through the state of Minnesota, many of those are not positive contacts. They are possibly a citation and not a warning or an arrest. There were only 6 citizen complaints against troopers, and only 2 of those 6 were sustained. So I'm quite, again, proud that the troopers are treating people with respect as they do their job. Troopers traveled over 18 million miles patrolling the highways of the state of Minnesota. They investigated 20,380 crashes, arrested 5,449 impaired drivers, provided 57,000 assists to the motoring public, assisted a local law enforcement and allied agencies 16,196 times, fielded and handled 49,615 driving complaints, inspected over 42,000 commercial vehicles, inspected over 21,000 school buses, and again, within that, there was 2 sustained complaints on Minnesota State Troopers. Yeah. Talk about statewide traffic trends for a moment, if I may. In 2012, as of today, there were 390 traffic deaths in 2012. That's a slight increase from last year, which was record-setting at 368 deaths. Thus far, 2013 is trending down from 2012. Last year at this time, January and February, were horrible years for fatalities in Minnesota. Many, multiple fatality-involved crashes. And once that trend started on the high end, it kind of carried through the rest of the year. So we're trending quite well right now. Despite the last year's increase, 2011 and 2012 are the only 2 years with fewer than 400 traffic deaths since 1944. So Minnesota is a safe state to drive in. Traffic deaths are down 40% over the past decade, and teen traffic deaths are down 68%. So again, very, very positive figures. Seatbelt use is at a record rate of 94% right now, and there's not many states in the country that have a higher seatbelt compliance rate than Minnesota right now. I spoke of the DWI arrests. That's actually trending down. In 2008, law enforcement in Minnesota, not just State Patrol, arrested over 35,000 impaired drivers. And in 2012, it was 27,879. So I look again upon that as a positive, that fewer folks are being arrested. Hopefully they're making good decisions to not drink and drive or having a sober cab take them home. Just a general overview. Some of you may know these patrol districts quite intimately, but there's 11 patrol districts around the state of Minnesota where field operations are based. There's one in Rochester, one in Mankato, one in Marshall, one in East Metro, one in the West Metropolitan area, St. Cloud, Duluth, Brainerd, Detroit Lakes, Virginia, and Thief River Falls. So 11 operational patrol districts. Our primary job is patrolling the highways, road patrol duties, but we also have additional responsibilities. We have an investigative service section, and that consists of a crash reconstruction team. Those are four troopers who work primarily the metro area, but they will respond to greater Minnesota in the event of a horrific crash, such as the crash, such as the Cottonwood school bus crash. In addition to those four troopers, there's 42 other troopers stationed around the state that do crash investigations or reconstructions. We have a vehicle crimes unit with eight troopers members, and we have criminal patrol canine teams, 14 troopers with canines, again, scattered throughout the state. We just heard from Major Meyerson. We have Capitol Security, which Major Meyerson is in charge of. We have a special response team, which is a group of troopers trained in not only special tactics, but rescue as well. They work with our aviation unit. And those are the troopers you often see here at the Capitol during events with large crowds or contentious meetings or events. Those special response troopers were initially formed for Capitol response. So those are the folks you see. We have four public information officers. We have an aviation section with three helicopters, and I believe it right now it's five fixed-wing Cessnas, troopers stationed up in the Brainerd area, as well as the metro area. We have a commercial vehicle enforcement division, and as of today, your fact sheet, I think, reflects 788 State Patrol employees total. Today, I believe it's 783, but there's a 537 sworn State Patrol troopers, 67 commercial vehicle inspectors, 40 Capitol Security officers, and 78 support staff, and 61 total radio communication operators and radio communication supervisors. The State Patrol has a strategic plan, and as part of that strategic plan, we have four overarching goals for the agency and the members. The first one is to reduce the deaths, injuries, property damage, and life-changing events on Minnesota roadways. The second goal is to maximize service to the public and provide assistance to our allied agencies. We work very, very closely around the state with counties and city police departments, as well as our federal partners and the DNR as well. The third overarching goal is to effectively acquire and strategically deploy resources while enhancing organizational efficiency, which we try to be as efficient as possible. The fourth overarching goal is to recruit, develop, and retain a quality, diverse workforce. I spoke again about the fatality rates in 2011 and 2012. In 2011, the fatality rate of deaths per 100 million miles traveled in Minnesota was 0.65. If you compare that with 1980, it was 3.0. So the deaths have gone down steadily since 1980. In 2011, we were number two to Massachusetts in being the safest state in the United States to drive in. So again, that's quite an accomplishment. We will be up a little bit from 2012, the increase of 22 folks that died on our roadways last year, but I don't have that number yet, but it's likely we'll be second to Massachusetts again. Just some statistics for comparison, and this is from 1980 to 2011. When we look at that miles traveled, 100 million miles traveled, from 1980 to 2011, that's doubled. So there's a lot more miles driven in the state, twice as many as in 1980. The motor vehicles that are driving on the roads, it's up 60+% from 1980. So more miles driven, more vehicles. Licensed drivers up 45%. The state population about a little over 30% increase since 1980. And the reason I bring these up to the committee today is that coincidentally the troopers in 1980 is approximately the same number we have today. So you can see there's more cars, more drivers, more population, the troopers are numbers about the same. So with that same number of troopers, again, I think we're doing excellent work. Just a little bit about funding. It was discussed a little bit earlier. The vast majority of the State Patrol funding is trunk highway funding. We do have some general fund dollars. It's ebbed and flowed since 1996, but it's been flat since 2009. So we've had the same budget since 2009, which I look to as a positive. Again, we didn't have any cuts since 2009. Of that budget, 92% is a total of salary and benefits, equipment, vehicles, and vehicle repairs, and fuel, supplies, and uniforms. That's 92% of our budget. Actually, 82% is salary and benefits, and that's gone up over the last several years. I don't think that's unusual for employees in the state of Minnesota. Another comparison that I thought was a little bit interesting. I call it the Midwest comparison, although Colorado is in this group of 11. But in the states of Nebraska, Kansas, Colorado, Illinois, Michigan, North Dakota, South Dakota, Missouri, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, the only state patrol, highway patrol, state police agency, and this is compared to that those vehicle miles traveled per trooper, we're only ahead of Wisconsin. And in the country, we're ranked 46th, which actually is an increase from about 5 years ago. We were 48th in the country. So again, other states, folks don't drive as many miles. There's not as many registered vehicles and drivers. They have more troopers. But again, Minnesota is a very, very safe state to drive in.
Colonel, if you can sort of wind up, or at least I want to ask at this point if anyone has any questions so people can, because we only have about 10 minutes left. Representative Hillstrom, then Kiefer.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask it when he's finished, if I can.
When he's finished. Representative Kiefer, then Uglum. If you don't mind, Colonel, if we can do this, because I'd like to get...
Don't make sure. That's fine.
Mr. Chair?
Okay. Representative Kiefer.
Thank you. Since we're talking about the pie chart here, I just wondered, and you, Colonel Daly, do you have any concerns about the potential gas tax or tax on services, because that could affect your budget? Just wondered. Thank you.
Colonel Daly.
Yes. Every day when I drive to work, I look at the price of fuel. Every 10-cent increase in that fuel cost is $100,000 to our budget. And there is, in the governor's budget, a proposal for $1 million supplement each year of the next biennium. So if fuel costs increase, there's fewer troopers because we have to keep trooper positions over. So yes, I watch it quite closely, and I'm very concerned.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Representative
it.
Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, again, along those lines, because we're all concerned about fuel prices and things. Through your purchasing, do you guys hedge at all in terms of fuel prices, or do you contract directly with distributors for bulk purchases and things like that, or do you just essentially buy at the pump?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we buy at the pump around the state. We do encourage the troopers to look for the lowest price fuel in their area, and we do the same thing with vehicle repairs to our squads. We use local vendors, and again, encourage the troopers to look for the lowest cost oil changes and vehicle maintenance as well.
Representative Uglum.
Mr. Chair. Yes, I mean, along one thing, and just a thought at least for you to consider, there are many organizations. The North Metro Mayors Group, for one, has cooperative purchasing for a number of things. Actually, police ammunition is one for the North Metro police departments and things like that. And to enter into some type of cooperative purchasing agreement, leveraging your fuel purchases with a supplier for some additional discounts and things like that. A lot of it, of course, is being done in private industry in any way that you can. There's a lot of suppliers out there that would love to have the State Patrol's business. And even if you ended up with a 5% discount or something like that, could be obviously very, very significant. So just a thought to look into some of that, but there are a number of organizations that are doing that type of thing. Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Colonel, I was wondering if you and Mr. Chair, if you could just get me the facts on the number of hours your officers spend in the implied consent hearings. There's a bill moving around to talk about moving the implied consent hearings to the Office of Administration or Administrative Hearings. If you could just somehow, if it's coded, if you could get me the number of hours your officers spend in these hearings, implied consent hearings. And then the other one is just, I think the number of your complaints against your officers has something to do with your good academy that you put on. And do you have the backing of your commissioner up there that you'll keep it a good, rough, tough academy and not turn it into a wishy-washy college atmosphere? I mean, you're going to keep it like a boot camp, or what's your long-range plan for your academy?
Mr. Chair,
Colonel Daly.
Representative Cornish, I concur with the our excellent academy. We actually have 47 cadets in our Trooper Academy. This is the fourth week. We started with 48, and we also started with 9 alternates, and we went through all the alternates, and we're actually down 47. I intended to graduate 48. We prepare the folks for that tough academy. It is a modified stress academy because troopers oftentimes work by themselves. They're in the middle of nowhere dealing with some people that may want to cause them or someone else harm, and we need to put that stress on those folks to know how they'll handle that pressure and that stress. It is my intention to keep the academy a modified stress academy, and we do strive to improve it each and every year. We can always improve it incrementally, and I think we've done that over about the last 5 or 6 years.
Thank you.
Members, we have session at 12, so I want to adjourn at 11:30. Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad if Representative Hills were closing in on time. You had a question you wanted to ask.
Representative Ward before he's passing. Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, Colonel, my question was just on a piece of funding. So where is your Vehicle Crimes Task Force funded out of? What pool of money is that from your, is that transportation? Is that because it's vehicles, or is more of an investigative piece?
Yeah,
Colonel Daly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is more investigative. I did not bring that form that up with me. That is funded through the Trunk Highway User Fund, I believe. Maybe Representative Hillstrom will help me out with that funding piece.
Well, Mr. Chair, and that's fine. I just wanted to make sure that's a good program, and I want to obviously give you a little bit of kudos on that, because I don't know if the general public remembers, or this committee, maybe some of them, but the reason that Danny Hecker is sitting in prison right now is because of the Minnesota State Patrol. So thank you very much.
And Colonel, do you...
Thank you, Representative.
Colonel, do you still provide staff assistance to any local law enforcement agencies? I was thinking about Minneapolis in particular a few years ago. Do you?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we actually have one trooper on a task force with the DEA right now, but that's the only trooper that's deployed to another agency.
Very good. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a little off topic, which is why I wanted to wait till last. Are you aware, or you don't have to answer this, but right now your troopers are being audited by the department, the tax department, because the federal government recognizes the lunch time that your officers take and the state does not. And so for the last 3 years, they're now going back and auditing your officers and making them reimburse the state for a deduction that is recognized federally. And so one of the reasons is because you don't have a policy that they can't bring a bag lunch in their car. So I wanted to bring that issue to your attention, and I wanted you to maybe work with the department, because it's really sad if our officers are being re-audited and reimbursing the state of Minnesota for something that they have to do because of their job. I understand that Minnesota troopers, they take a 30-minute lunch, and if they get called at lunch, they have to leave. And if they don't, there's serious ramifications for their licensure. And I just think it's unfair to have them be punished in a way that we set up the rules for them. That's all.
Colonel Daly, do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, thank you for your comments. I appreciate it.
I guess that was the extent of the comment. Any further discussion? Thank you, Colonel, for your presentation. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.